So, yeah, I have an identity crisis. Anyway, my name is Lynn, and I am an alcoholic. And the reason it gets confusing is because I got sober in my teens in Alcoholics Anonymous. So I got sober under the name of Lynn Dugan. And a lot of you may know family members of mine. Then I was married and so on, and life goes on. But I got sober in Virginia and eventually moved to Maryland. I've lived in St. Louis, so I've been lots of different things. But the bottom line is that never changed is I am a grateful member of Alcoholics Anonymous, truly. My sobriety date is August 24th, 1982. So in 2 weeks, God willing, I will be celebrating Alcoholics Anonymous 31 years of sobriety. And I don't take any credit for that, in that I truly believe, and I'll talk a little bit about my story, but I truly believe my higher power picked my sobriety date. And I never had the reason to go against that or change that. You know, I got to participate in my recovery, but it has been given to me as a true gift from my higher power to be able to do this, because there's more people out there drinking that didn't get this opportunity, and all I had to do was participate. And it made recovery so much easier. And I love this program. You know, how many people out there other than us actually get a place to go and get directions on how to live this thing we call life? You know, and I've had the incredible opportunity in that, I mean, I drank for 9 years. I came in here, I turned 17, and I have over 31 years of experience in recovery. So where is my experience, strength, and hope now is in the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I want to talk a lot about that, although I will qualify. But in that experience, if you think about it, over the time, I learned how to date. I learned how to have a family. I learned how to be a mother. I'm not a grandmother yet, but I went to college, and I learned how to be crazy, and I learned how to be responsible, and I learned how to go to meetings when I didn't want to go to meetings, and I've learned how to live a life through the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I came into AA, I came in here because drinking was killing me. You know, I was at that jumping off place that the book talks about, that I couldn't imagine life with alcohol and I couldn't imagine life without it. And it talks about a loneliness and a despair that few of us know except in this room. I came in here with that and no other hope, and thinking I was resigned to church basements, smoke-filled church basements with a bunch of old men. That's what AA looked like to me. I mean, in 1982, everybody was smoking in meetings, so there was a service position of cleaning out ashtrays, and I was good at that. And I would say that three-quarters, if not more, of the meetings were men. At about 5 years of sobriety, I ended up in Harrisonburg. I went to school down at JMU, and for an entire year that I was down there, I was the only woman in Alcoholics Anonymous for a while there. And then late in my second year down there, two women showed up, and that was like a big deal. So then there were three of us in AA for a while. And that's what I'm familiar with, which gets a little scary, ladies, if you think about it, that most of the good advice I got on dating was learned from men in Alcoholics Anonymous, okay? So I always kind of qualify, you know, it's all in progress, right? It's all in progress. But the core fundamental values on how I live my life come from Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, outsiders will say, you know, well, you've been brainwashed in that AA program. Well, my brain needed to be washed by AA. You know, I was going nowhere and nowhere fast. You know, I started drinking. I don't even remember when I started drinking, because I grew up in a family that, just simply put, I'll just go with the stereotypes. Irish Catholic, alcoholic living in New Jersey. Okay, that's where I was born, in Atlantic City, okay? So I was ready to roll. But in growing up, it it was part of my family. You know, alcoholics were not, that was not a bad or a negative word. That defined the men in my life. That defined what life was about. And, you know, you got to grow up and drink. That was something to look forward to. That was like a, you know, a rite of passage. I remember thinking how great it was that I could, when, as soon as I could, toddle and go from the couch to the refrigerator. I knew the difference between Schmitz and Rolling Rock, you know. That's how I learned my colors. Oh, green, I know the green one. And, you know, and the reward was if you got the right beer and you brought it to the right person, you got to have a sip, you know. So I don't remember how old I was when I started drinking. But I, it was always like, oh, look, isn't she great? Look, honey, sit on my lap. Would you like a sip of beer? I love sitting on laps and drinking beer. I spent a lot of time doing that. But that's not what I consider my first drink. I really don't. I don't know if I liked or didn't like the taste of alcohol. It really never occurred to me to make a decision about that because I just always assumed that I would drink. I liked the way it made people relax. And when I could get closer, and I remember this as a little kid, that when once they started drinking, they were so much friendlier. And they would slow down, and they would play, and they would laugh. And I never had a negative view of alcohol. So it may have been dysfunctional, but, you know, my family put the word fun in dysfunctional. You know, we did a lot of crazy stuff, but I didn't know it was crazy or dysfunctional. I really didn't because it was what my normal was. Now, having families, that didn't drink, I don't know what that's about. You know, we drank hard and you go to church and you fish and that's what you do and you go to work and that's what I remember about my summers and that's what I loved about it. But my first drink, I was 9 and it was beer. I saw a babysitter brought it over, and she had plans for it, and I immediately knew what to do with that beer. You know, it was in my refrigerator, and I informed her that if she didn't allow that to become mine, I would inform all of the neighborhood that she was a drinking babysitter, and she would never get work again. So at 9 years old, I'm blackmailing my babysitter for my first six-pack. And that's how I began drinking. And if you think about it, the end of my drinking wasn't much different. You know, I drank a six-pack by myself when I first started, and at the very end, I was by myself drinking again at a jumping-off place. I did not know in that very beginning what alcohol would do, but I'll tell you, on beer 5, I had found the meaning of life. Now, I don't know if I was one of those drinkers that the switch turned on from the very moment I drank. You know, I remember being exposed to alcohol at the dining room table one time. They decided they would, my father was, I guess, had gotten into recovery at that point. He was in and out and all around, so I'm not quite sure what was happening there. One of those secret controlled, I'll do it on my own kind of guys. And I think he was he might have come to AA at that point. I don't remember. But I remember they were going to introduce alcohol socially in my family. And I remember experiencing compulsion, and I was probably 7, that I drank mine, I drank my brother's, I asked for more, and they said no, and I thought I was going to lose it. So I went into the kitchen and drank more. That I remember doing, but I didn't get the effect of alcohol. My first drink was on that 5th beer, and I remember that 5th beer, and that's what I counted. Because I swear the sky parted, there were angels singing. You know, it was one of those, I had found the answer. I felt comfortable, and I didn't know I didn't feel comfortable. I felt right with the world. I felt like I had meaning and purpose in the world, and I wasn't floundering around. Now, did I make the decision that I wanted to be alcoholic? I don't know. All I knew was at that very moment, I had found what I was searching for, and I had made a commitment to myself that as many times as I could get the opportunity to do this, I would do this again and again. And I then understood why people wanted to grow up. And at 9 years old, I knew why I wanted to be an adult, because I wanted to be able to drink like this. Because adults get to sit on the back porch and drink whenever they want, was a nine-year-old's point of view. I didn't realize alcohol was, I was responding differently. I didn't know that drinking five beers to get a buzz was, and that created that overwhelming power. And I, you know, that the five beers gave me a purpose in life. I had a peculiar mental twist from the very beginning of my drinking. I not only loved what alcohol did for me, I worshipped that feeling. And that became my higher power. You know, that was a power greater than me that I was seeking as often as I could. And so I could relate to wanting to drink. Shortly thereafter, you know, alcohol was illegal and so was everything else. So there's a lot of everything else that went in my story. But the interesting thing, alcohol stayed with me. You know, I learned, But somehow in all of my drinking, it was my Band-Aid. It kept me glued together. Now, at 9 years old, it's really hard to go to fourth grade and be drunk. It really is hard to do that. But it is not, and you think, you know, I mean, my story is about this alcoholic kid, really. And I don't want to get into a big drunkologue on what it's like to be, you know, an after-school special, drinking alcohol and doing other things, because a lot of you can't relate to that. But what I think you can relate to is, as my drinking progressed, and I learned this in sobriety more than I learned it while I was drinking, but as I looked at the book and it talked about willingness to go to any lengths for our sobriety, I couldn't understand that until I looked at my drinking. And when I drank, I was willing to go to any lengths to drink. I turned my will and my life over to the care of alcohol without hesitation, doubt, or balking. And when I could apply what AA was teaching me about sobriety back to my drinking, I could understand how I was an alcoholic. Because I had so many excuses when I look at my drinking and go, yeah, but I was so young. Couldn't it have been a phase? You couldn't be a real alcoholic. And then the book even defines real alcoholic for us. How could that possibly be? You know, and I hear young people come in and say that all the time. I came in for a while, but I didn't stick around. I stuck around, not because I didn't hear the excuses of, oh, you're too young to be an alcoholic. I was in college, living in a dorm at JMU, and I stayed sober. And it wasn't like I wasn't surrounded by all those influences. And I made a lot of crazy decisions in recovery. But the bottom line is, I can't deny there is something that happens when I take a drink, in that I can't have one. I've never just wanted one. Ever in my life did I ever want a drink. And if I ever was in a situation, I don't know if you did this, if you're going to a party or a social event, or you knew you needed to be drinking socially in front of other people, but you didn't want to look like you had a problem, you'd pre-drink at the party. You know, you'd have to, it was like, you gotta get, and you didn't want even, I mean, I would go on dates that way, because it was really embarrassing to go on a date and to be on beer 14, you know? And they're like, what is wrong with you? And I get these sarcastic comments. What, are you an alcoholic or something? I didn't know how to answer any of that. So I would pre-drink my dates, you know, because I knew my drinking was peculiar. You know, and that's the way I learned how to live. It was always a secret. But in that secret of my drinking, alcohol became my very best friend. I had a relationship, my biggest relationship. At first, I had parents, and there was a relationship there, and then there was alcohol. And it allowed me to have a relationship with everybody else. You know, parents have to put up with you, tolerate you, love you, whatever they have to do. But the rest of the world really doesn't have to. You know, they can come in, they can come out, you can change friends. You can feel awkward. You have lots of feelings. I remember lots of feelings. Now remember, I started drinking at 9 years old, even before puberty. So that didn't even kick in. So really, I didn't know what to do with any of those. And alcohol made everything manageable. Everything became manageable under the influence of alcohol. The only problem that came with it was I immediately had a tolerance, which I thought was a complete gift, right? That made me a good drinker. Like, I definitely don't have a problem because I could drink and I could drive. I could drive everybody home. I was less intoxicated. I wasn't staggering. I could talk. I could negotiate, manipulate, and get us through any situation. I wasn't the falling down, throwing up in the bathroom person. I was the one that you'd turn to and say, oh, she's really had too much to drink. Do you think you can help her out? I looked like I had it together. But we all know, you know, that it was tolerance, tolerance, tolerance. And those were good for a while. But then slowly alcohol turned on me, and I didn't realize it was turning on me. And I don't know if this happened to you, but over time, then the blackouts came. And they came more often, and then they became longer and longer and longer. And around that same time that my blackouts were getting longer and longer and longer, that craving of needing more and more and more. So it wasn't about the drinking at night anymore, and it wasn't about drinking on long weekends, which started on Thursday and would end up on Sunday night. I then needed to get through the week. So then I needed to drink every day. And it was just a little bit. I didn't need to get drunk. I just needed a little help, a little help. And then the blackouts were coming sooner and sooner and sooner. So I'd need to drink more often, and then the blackouts would come in. And my life had started to get unmanageable. And I thought I was going crazy because I couldn't remember. I didn't know what alcoholism was. You know, I just figured I was getting through. As long as I looked on the outside like I didn't have a problem, I knew I could continue to drink. Because, see, the worst thing that I could thought could ever happen to me while I was drinking was that somebody would tell me I had to stop drinking. And I was not my own life manager at this point. I was a dependent. So there were lots of people who had a lot to say about how I lived my life. So I learned to put on a facade. And everything about me was that way. And I learned that around my drinking. My life was focused and centered on drinking. So I realized if I looked and acted like the all-American teenager, that people would leave me alone, which meant my job was to get really good grades and work a lot so I could afford my drinking and nobody would question me about my drinking. I had to look the part. And so a lot of the decisions that I had made in my life were just around my drinking. The idea of did I like it or not didn't matter anymore. I learned how to make decisions saying, well, that's the best thing for me to do because of my drinking. That's the best thing to do because that's... I mean, I even chose friends that way. I was very social in high school. And the reason that worked really well for me was you didn't want to make any one group angry because you never wanted to miss an opportunity to drink. Never wanted to miss an opportunity to drink. So I was everyone's friend, but I didn't know anybody. I didn't know me because my very best friend was alcohol. And on a daily basis, I learned to turn my will and my life over to alcohol and suffer the consequences wherever that would take me. Toward the end of my drinking, I don't know if you've had that experience where it was a typical night drinking, whatever that meant, and that would change over time what typical was. And then you wake up the next morning, and before I'd even open my eyes, I'd wonder, where am I? And then I would open my eyes and realize, especially if I was at home, I was always like, yes, I made it back. Because I never remembered what day it was, where I had been the night before, and more importantly, who I had been with. And this was the days before cell phones and computers, so Facebook was not around to help me out at all. That I'd have to start calling the best friend. And you knew something happened when people started hanging up on you right away. And then I would walk out to the car to see what kind of condition the car was in. So first you'd have to inspect the outside of the car. And then I would inspect the inside and I'd go for clues. And that's how I lived my life. And that's what it was like being a kid that was an alcoholic. And that wasn't a problem. I didn't see a problem with any of that. You know, I mean, I've got the crazy stories of running from, you know, I had to have outside resources and contacts and little business associates that were, you know, created havoc and crazy stuff in my life. And, you know, I did take off and leave the state a few times and go places. And I've got all the wild stories that go with, you know, crazy young alcoholic girl drinking. But that doesn't, the crazy stories are just stories. They're not my alcoholism, you know. What happened with my alcoholism, despite the crazy, because you can be a non-alcoholic and have crazy. But where alcoholism took me was in a place inside myself, in that I couldn't look myself in the mirror, and I had no idea who I was. And every once in a while, I'd catch a glimpse of that woman in the mirror and realize that all of my decisions were based around alcohol, not around integrity or principles or what I had been raised with. That there was no substance to me, and that I had character, but I gave it up for alcohol. Any moral values I had, I would compromise them just for my next drink. And at 17 years old, I had nothing to live for. And that sounds crazy to me. That at 17, the purpose of getting up every day was to drink. Period. It was crazy. I ended up, I did date in high school and did the normal thing. And I don't know if you remember the early 80s, but mothers were getting really mad at drunk drivers, and that was a big rage. And it was before Nancy Reagan got mad and started that whole thing. But it was before DWIs were actually something that people got arrested for. But it was a weird flux of time. And so drinking, people weren't quite sure what to do with all of that. And toward the 80s, it got popular that everybody needed to go to a rehab. And so they were sucking up, all of my friends were going into rehabs. And all I knew about a rehab was I had a friend in school one day, and then they were gone for 6 months. When this started to happen, I decided, and I was starting to go in withdrawal during the day, I knew I couldn't stay in high school anymore because I couldn't drink and keep away withdrawal. So I dropped out of high school, primarily because of drinking. And I enrolled in community college. The whole purpose of that was, it wasn't that I didn't want to go to school, it was I needed to be able to drink in between classes in order to make it through classes. And because I realized I was starting to hallucinate. And rather than think there's something wrong with being 17 and hallucinating, my solution was there's something wrong with high school that I can't manage my hallucinations. So I need to find a solution. And that's how alcohol became my best friend, because it was there with me all the time. It wasn't, I'm not going to give some glorious, exciting story, but what alcohol did was alcohol was my primary purpose. So how can I not be a real alcoholic? And it didn't matter that I was 17 years old. I couldn't live with it, and I couldn't live without it. And I tried. And the only reason I ended up coming into Alcoholics Anonymous was because my higher power picked my sobriety date. And the way that occurred was, I had a fake ID, of course. And back then, we had, remember, Virginia IDs? You had your picture on the front, and then you had a paper insert. Well, if you could erase and then use a blue pen, you could change the date. And I had tons of fake IDs, and they worked great. Now they have, like, you know, secret super codes and stuff. Back then, it was really easy. So I could go to the ABC store and buy 151 all the time, because that was my drink of choice after a while. Then when my stomach got a little too upset over the 151, I had to move to more vodka and gin, that my stomach could handle that a little bit better. And then if it was a good day, I could do Everclear, you know. And that's how I drank. I never sat around and socially drank. I didn't drink for the taste. I drank for the effect. So if other people were out drinking margaritas or whatever they were drinking, that was great for them. I was not a beer connoisseur. It was beer, and the answer was yes. I don't care if it was Milwaukee's Best or something else. You know, this whole microbrewery thing, I don't get the idea of that. It's like it's beer. You know, who knows what it tastes like? When you just open your throat, it goes down, you wait for the effect, it bounces back up the back of your neck, and you know if it's good. And that's the way I drank. So all that other stuff, I mean, to date it a little bit, I remember thinking in early recovery, I guess it was like maybe a year or two into sobriety, what'd they come out with? Wine coolers. And I'm like, oh, I've never had a wine cooler. And then I paused for a minute and thought, I would not even want to drink a wine cooler. I mean, the closest I came to it was probably like cold duck. And I'm thinking, that doesn't sound very good to me. I wasn't a social drinker. I was not a social drinker. I drank for the effect, and I always did. I don't know why that on switch got turned on so early, other than that was just a gift from my higher power. You know, now I truly look at it as a true gift. But toward the end of my drinking, what actually happened was, being young, I had this logic. And this was, I felt good when I drank, so therefore I should drink. My stomach was killing me every time I ate food. So you shouldn't eat food. And just do it to survive. So as long as alcohol, which contained calories, which in definition of health class was a food, anything with calories was a food, therefore I could live off of alcohol. And that was my logic. That led to my demise pretty quickly. Because I ended up with alcoholic gastritis. I didn't know that's what it was. And so the only time I could eat was when I was drinking, to get food in me, because otherwise the food wouldn't stay down. I just kept getting sick. So I was like the opposite of the anorexic. I'd have to drink a lot and then shove food down, and the alcohol would help me keep the food down. But when I sobered up, food wouldn't stay in with me at all. So meanwhile, alcohol became my primary source of nutrition. Eventually, that led me to crazy. And my thinking was not clear at all, to the point that people would look at me and go, my God, Lynn, what happened to you? You look terrible. And meanwhile, I had all these friends being sucked up into rehabs, and they'd come back out, and they'd say, we'd really love to hang out with you, but we really need you to not drink. And I'm thinking, oh, my God, that would be like the worst thing in the world. What would life be like without drinking? I had never known how to live without a drink. I couldn't imagine a life without a drink. So I chose alcohol over friends. You know, that I remember my mother pointing out to me, I had gone to six or eight funerals my first year of sobriety, from friends, because that was the life I was living. You know, I have been to funerals, but I've never been to six or eight in the same year of young people before. You know, but that's how I was living, and that seemed perfectly normal to me. You know, the subtlety of alcoholism came, but it was slow. But in the very end, I was blacking out a lot, and I really would miss long periods of time. I remember going on a geographical tour, and I was trying to get sober. I was running away from one of my business associates, and I needed to leave town very quickly. So I decided it would be really good to head north, and I forgot to pack money. So I couldn't make it through the tolls, and then the car broke down, and then I needed to, you know, one thing led to another. I ended up in New York City. That wasn't working out. I needed to go to Cape Cod. Met a guy on a bus. Now I'm trying to stay sober through this craziness. Met a guy on a bus who was just coming out of rehab. And I thought, okay, me and whatever this guy's name, he was blonde, on the bus, we're heading to Cape Cod, and we're going to do this sober thing. And I went to my first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. I guess it was in like 1980 or 81. And I remember going in the meeting, and you know what I heard? It was in Hyannisport. And I heard, some of us can't quit everything all at one time. but keep coming back. And so what I heard out of that was, you can do other drugs, just don't drink. I went out that night and I did something, and I can't tell you what I did. I did a substance of some sort, could have been alcohol. I don't remember, because I didn't come out of that blackout for 6 more weeks. And I came out of that blackout in my own bed back in Northern Virginia, waking up going, oh my God, what just happened? Where am I? And how am I going to play this off? I knew there was a problem, but I didn't want to talk about it. So what do we do when we have stressed out problems? We drink. So that's how I handled that problem, is I continue to drink. And that's where my drinking was that summer. I would just play it off. I didn't even contact the friends anymore because I didn't want, because I was missing so much information, I didn't want them to know that I didn't know, because it was starting to get uncomfortable. So I would go to bars alone, and I would go to parties alone, and I would drive myself because I didn't want other people knowing the details of my drinking. I knew it wasn't right, but I knew I wasn't willing to give it up. And I would do anything to protect my drinking, even though I was dying inside. I couldn't look myself in the mirror at this point, and all I did was survive for alcohol. I do remember I was drinking my last night, and I was in a bar in one of the last bar I was in. I remember leaving, and I was in Fairfax, and I had to drive all the way back to Reston. And I would hit the 7-Eleven before it closed, and I would get a 12-pack to take home and drink that night. And I remember hitting the 7-Eleven before it was closing on, I don't even know what time that is, 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning, to get my 12-pack to get home. And on my way out of 7-Eleven with my 12-pack, a group of guys grabbed me and threw me in the back of their car and drove off with me. Now, there's a lot of things I should be thinking about. When a group of guys grabs you in the middle of the night in front of a 7-Eleven that you don't know, you've never seen them before, and they're throwing you in the back of a car and driving off, the only thought that was going through my mind is, they want my beer. They want my beer. That's all I could think about. And they knew my name. So I get in the back of this car, and I'm like, hey. Now, the second thought was it was a business associate gone bad. But they didn't look like that group of friends. So it could have been. I mean, I didn't look like that group of friends either with that business associate. But so I'm thinking maybe I got some paybacks to do, or they just want my beer is really where I was thinking. And so I'm like, hey, you know, trying to play this off cool. I'm in the back of a car that I don't know with a bunch of stinky boys, and I'm like, hey, you want some beer, right? And they're like, no, Lynn, we don't want your beer. And I'm like, oh, they know my name. I'm like, okay, so you know who I am. Do you know my brothers? What's going on here? No, we know about your drinking. And I'm like, ugh, they're really going to take my beer away. That's the only thing that happened. You know, a lot of people knew about my drinking. I lost a lot of friends about my drinking. So I'm thinking, okay, I'm going to get a lecture, go to Jesus, and I'll give you back your beer. And they're like, no, we just wanted to let you know you were about ready to be arrested for drunk in public or DWI, and we just thought we would talk to you now. We're on our way back from a meeting, and we saw you. So we're members of Alcoholics Anonymous, and we thought maybe you would like to go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I, of course, said, of course I do. I would love to go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, not having a clue. And that kind of a resentment against AA because it was sucking up all my friends. And they proceeded to tell me something about AA, which went like, wah, 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 wah. That's all I heard. But we'll give you back your beer. And I did hear that. And so I politely listened to wah, 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 wah. I got my beer back, I got in my car, and they did say at the very end, we will call you tomorrow, and if you haven't had a drink, we will bring you to a meeting of AA. I said, great idea, I will wait for your call. And you know how sincere that was, right? I got my beer back. I was a happy girl. You know, and they circled around, made sure the cop wasn't there. So I even had a clean getaway. I was like, this, I've salvaged this night. You know, I got my beer, I'm going home. But what happened was, when I got home that night, and I don't know if this has happened to you, it was just me and the beer. And I couldn't drink the feelings away. And so I realized I was scamming everyone, including myself, and I couldn't make that feeling stop. And I wanted to stop feeling. And usually alcohol would work, and it stopped working. And I was still feeling, and I was drinking, and I was feeling, and I was drinking, and thinking, is this what my life has come to? I mean, I have to go to Alcoholics Anonymous? This is what I have to look forward to? And I proceeded to OD. I had a lot of other substances around, and I decided to take them all. And none of them mixed with alcohol carefully. So I took them all at the same time and then proceeded to finish that 12-pack. And the feeling still didn't go away. And I'm drinking. Now, I'm doing this kind of rapidly because we don't sip beers, right? You know, we just don't, especially when we're feeling bad. We're, like, down in the things. So it's all a matter of probably a couple minutes here. And I'm down in these things and down in these things. The thoughts wouldn't go away and the feelings wouldn't die. And I hit my knees. And at that point, I hit my knees. And I don't know if you've said this prayer or not, but God, heal me right here and right now and let me die. Or save me, because I don't know what else to do. And I happened to do it after I OD'd, you know, and took all those pills. By all rights, I should have died that night. I took an incredible amount of the stuff that it should have killed, like six elephants. And I was probably about 20, 30 pounds lighter than I am right now. By all rights, I should have been dead. And I'd already been in the bar and drank like 8 Long Island iced teas. I had the 12-pack going. I did the fistful of drugs. I shouldn't have lived through that night. Logically, I should not have lived through that night. But what ended up happening is I remember praying that prayer, and I passed out in the middle of that prayer on my knees. I woke up the next morning to my phone ringing at 2 o'clock in the afternoon saying, have you had a drink? And I remember, you know, that hello. You know, your eyes aren't even open. You're like scrambling around for the thing that's ringing. You're not sure if it's a phone or an alarm. You just wanted to shut up. And I grabbed it, and it was the phone, and I said, no, you're waking me up. And the voice on the other end was, good, we're coming to get you. We'll be there in 5. And it was those people from Alcoholics Anonymous that took me to my first meeting. I didn't pick my sobriety date. My higher power did. You know, I never had a good idea to get sober. I was just desperate enough to be willing to listen to the solution. Got to that first meeting, and I went to 3 meetings before they decided I needed to be in a detox. But and people in Alcoholics Anonymous made sure I got there. And I think it had something to do with that first meeting I went to, and they introduced me to another woman, and they said, Lynn, this is Jody. She is your temporary sponsor. And I said, great. Good. What's the temporary sponsor? And they said, she will answer every question that you have about Alcoholics Anonymous, so go sit with her and it'll be fine. And I remember thinking, this is awesome. And I said, Jody, I got a question. And she's like, sure, what is it? I said, I had a bug on my arm, real or imagined. That's when the whispering started in the back of the room. Like, the old timers would go back there and start talking and pointing and and then strange people would start coming up. Honey, how are you getting home tonight? Honey, where are you going to be tomorrow? Can I have your phone number? And that kind of talk. But they did end up getting me into a detox, thank God. Because I was not stable. I was medically not stable. You know, by the time I got to rehab, I really needed the detox. And I found out that this thing that was sticking out of my side that I thought was like, that I was just getting fat, crooked, that was my logic, was actually my liver that was sticking out. I learned that in rehab. So physically, I don't think I got a lot better until about month 9, because my liver enzymes were really a mess, and I was not the right color, and I was not looking good. But Alcoholics Anonymous loved me anyway. Now, I was a college student. I had a 4.0 3 months before. By the time I sobered up, I could read, and I could read out loud, but I couldn't comprehend any of the words that were in there, but I knew how to read. My brain wasn't working. So I couldn't read the big book and understand it. But I could understand when it was read to me, and I could understand your stories, and I would go to speakers meetings, and I could hear people talk about how they knew they were alcoholic and how they found their answer in Alcoholics Anonymous. And then the language, when I could read, the language didn't click with me. Not until I understood, if I put in the word alcohol for recovery, I then could relate to what they were talking about. So what does it mean to go to any lengths? I could understand it. What does it mean to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as we understand Him? That used to be like this big complex. What does it mean to turn my will and my life over to the care of God? You know, I made it all complicated, but I did it with alcohol every day. I had life experience with it. And when I realized through the help of the sponsor and you people that this really was a simple program, it could make sense. And all I had to do was show up, participate, get in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous, and don't drink no matter what. And that no matter what was going on, it would pass. And you know, that answer is still the same. If I show up, I get involved, and I participate, and I don't drink no matter what, the solution works. Because I have feelings all the time, but they're not an excuse to use and to go back out drinking. We all have feelings. We have good days. We have bad days. We have all kinds of days. But you know what? It's not a reason to drink. They're just a feeling. It's just a bad situation, a bad circumstance, a good circumstance. But they all do pass. But the funny thing is, when I was drinking, I did it alone. Even if I was in a crowd, I mean, how many of you did social drinking? I know I did this. I would alcoholically drink in a social situation. You know, it was all about me and my drink. I didn't care how you were drinking. As long as I was able to continue to drink, I'd talk to you. But if I pissed you off, I really didn't care. I was still going to drink. You know, God, what's wrong with them? They're so uptight. I'd keep drinking. It was all about my drinking, not about being social. I didn't care about the people around me. That's what social drinkers do. They bond and stuff. We do that in meetings. We get that idea that we connect in here. They do that over alcohol. Could you imagine wanting to do that? That just blows my mind. You have alcohol. Why do I need you? You know? I mean, you're fun to talk to. It's great to have somebody to draw, you know, listen to music on the way to the bar. But I didn't need you to drink. And that's that twisted alcoholic thinking. You know, I learned how to have relationships, and this book goes through it over and over and over again about how our difficulty is in relationships. But, you know, my relationships with you, as crazy and all over the place as they were when I first got here, taught me how to have a relationship with God. And you taught me how to have a relationship with a higher power. You know, I'm comfortable with my relationship with God, but at first, I was uncomfortable with that God word. So I went, you know, group of drunks, good orderly direction. I went with a lot of stuff. But it was over time. And I think the best question I ever asked when I was new, and try this, how do you communicate and find your higher power? And I would ask people that over and over and over again, because obviously the book keeps talking about it over and over, that we're not here to fix a drink problem. You know, we're here to work on our living problem. And I obviously didn't know how to live without alcohol. And I had no basis to compare it to. So I needed to ask you how you do it. Not just my sponsor, but I would come up and ask you. So, if you don't mind me asking, how do you talk to your God in your life? And you know what? Those are some of the best questions I've ever asked. Because we all have a different answer. Your answer is different than mine, and mine, God willing, will be a whole lot different next year than it is this year. Because I have found, I have this wonderful gift in that I have a relationship, a growing relationship with a higher power, coming up on 31 years. You know, it's not so much the gift of abstinence, it's the gift of living that I have today. I mean, I am grateful that my higher power picked that sobriety date for me. But it's not about not drinking. If I walked around about all the knots that I didn't get, all the drinks I haven't had, I'd be one resentful human being at 31 years of sobriety, right? I'd be pissed off. That's a lot of alcohol missed. But it's not about the alcohol. You know, what I did get an opportunity to do was I went to college sober. I have a 20-year-old who's never seen me drunk, you know? I have a 17-year-old who doesn't, the only understanding that she has about my drinking is when she comes and hears my story, you know? I have a whole group of friends around me that don't know me drinking. You know, there are a few that remember it, and I am blessed to have those people still in my life. I just celebrated with my brother. I guess it was about 3 weeks ago. My youngest brother, who came into this program at 15, just celebrated 25 years of sobriety. And I had the privilege of being asked to speak for him at his anniversary. Do you know the kind of relationship I can have with a brother in sobriety after 25 years? It's a true and incredible gift. He's one of my best friends. You know, I'm 9 years older than my youngest brother, or 8 years older, but he's one of my very best friends. And I love my sister-in-law that he's married to. And she has, I guess, 19 years. You know, that's a benefit of sobriety. You know, my nieces have never seen him intoxicated. I mean, I can laugh about his story now. And I treasure the memory of that. And I'm so glad it's only a memory. You know, I truly honor and respect him as a human being, and I can have relationships like that. I didn't know I wanted those kind of things when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. I wanted to stop hurting. I didn't want to stop drinking, but I knew I couldn't stop hurting without stopping the drinking. So I was resigned to church basements with old dudes and lots of cigarette smoke. And I thought, great, maybe I'll get well enough to go to bingo. And that's the way I thought recovery was going to be. But I had some glimmer of hope because I knew I was dying of alcoholism. And I didn't want to die, but I had no clue how to live. And what I can tell you is I made a lot of really dumb mistakes in recovery. So I don't know if this happened to you, but you get like your big girl pants on and you think, I've been sober a year now. I've got this thing. And I decided, well, I'm going to live life to the fullest. I didn't come into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I don't know where I got this quote from, but it's somewhere in the back of my mind. I didn't go to Alcoholics Anonymous just to go to meetings for the rest of my life. Well, you know what? I came into Alcoholics Anonymous to get out of pain. I didn't make that bet. I didn't go to Alcoholics Anonymous to go to meetings. I go to meetings. The difference now is I stopped asking myself if I feel like going to a meeting. I just go to a meeting. How I feel about going to a meeting is irrelevant. If you want to know how to stay active in AA for 30-some years, don't ask yourself how you feel about it. No one cares, and it doesn't matter. Because you'll go to a meeting if you're good. You can go to a meeting if you're bad. You can go to a meeting when the Redskins are playing. You can go to a meeting when it's raining. You can go to a meeting when you're sick. I advise you not to go to meetings with sick because, you know what, you're going to get other people sick. But you can definitely call your sponsor anyway. And if you are wondering whether you should go, whether you're sick or not, you ask your sponsor and he or she will tell you whether you should go to the meeting or not. But beyond that, I did stop asking myself how I felt about going to meetings. I stopped asking myself whether my sponsor's idea was good or not. I just did it. And it got a lot simpler. Now, I did dumb things like, okay, so I got my big girl pants on in about a year, so I decided I was going off to college. And I was going to live in the dorm. But I was going to do it safely, so I was going to go live in a non-drinking dorm, right? I mean, every college had a non-drinking dorm. You know what that meant. So, which means they just drank in secret, you know? So I went and lived in the dorm, and then I decided, well, I'm at college. I want the full college experience. I'm going to join a sorority. So I go ahead and I do that. Well, I truly want the college experience, so I'm going to become a little sister of a fraternity. But not one of the boring fraternities that's on campus. I needed to be the little sister of a fraternity that was off campus. And the reason they were off campus is because they weren't allowed on campus. I wonder why. And those were the people I was attracted to. Okay? Now, I'm not saying my thinking was right, but what I'm saying is, despite my best decisions, I have a higher power in my life who loves me enough that he guided me through that. Those were awful, bad, bad decisions, right? But I stayed sober. I'm not saying it was comfortable. I'm not saying I did it without pain. And I'm not saying I'd recommend it. But Alcoholics Anonymous was there for me. So even though I made mistakes, and my recovery is full of more mistakes than anything, because I don't know about you, but I learned through pain, you know? The only thing that happens over time is that my pain level changes. So what it used to take me a huge crash and burn, I don't have to go to the altitude that I used to have to go to and dive down. I can just go up a little and then crash, you know, little touchdowns every once in a while. The crashes aren't as big. That's what sobriety gave me. But I grow through pain, you know, and my tolerance of pain has gotten much, much smaller. You know, because I know how good it is to be in recovery. I know what it feels like to have a relationship with my higher power. And I know what it feels like to not be in relationship with that higher power. And that's a motivation of pain for me these days. When you don't have a relationship with a higher power, being in and out of a relationship doesn't matter because you don't have one anyway. But once you get one and you're out of it, you miss it. So it kind of changes my perspective. But no matter what it is, I don't drink. Because this too shall pass. There is nothing I have come across in recovery that I've had to take a drink over. Because I have you people in my life, I have a higher power in my life, and I have directions on how to live my life. And through all of that, nothing has ever failed me. And the other thing is, in all of this experience, I've never had to be alone ever like I was on that last night drinking. Where I was at that jumping off place, and where I did want to die, where I did want to die that night. I've never been that alone, ever, ever, ever in 31 years. And that's what I came into Alcoholics Anonymous for. Not for, I didn't come in here to do this, I want to have family. I mean, I went through that, right? That I have little kids, I need to stay at home, I need, me. And I became pretty darn miserable. You know, I had to go through that. You don't have to go through that. You know, you don't have to go through that. The answer's here, and it doesn't change. You know, the shiny newness of AA wore off a long time ago. But the miracle that occurs in here is not in who I haven't met, but it's in getting to know your story, because you tell mine. And I don't want to go back out. And I have the same disease that you do that wants to kill me. So if I get away from these meetings, I don't want to know what happens. I don't want to take another drink today. I don't. I don't have a compulsion to drink. And that has been removed from me ever since I did step 3. You know, when I was able to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understood him, because I had to have an understanding, I have not had a compulsion to drink. But if I go away from these meetings and I get away from my higher power, I assume it will return. Because you people who've gone back out, tell me that it does. You know, no matter how bad, no matter how bored, no matter how much you think you don't belong in an AA meeting, no matter how your story is different, special, and unique, that's exactly who I was. So as different, special, and as unique as you might think you are, you're sitting next to somebody who thinks the exact same thing next to you. Because we all came in here thinking, yeah, but I'm this. Yeah, that's good for them, but not me. We're all the yeah, buts. We are. Our stories are all unique. You don't have my story. I don't have yours, but we share the same disease. And it wants to kill us. But I'll tell you, even better than sharing a disease that wants to kill us, we get to share in a common solution. And, you know, the book talks about all being in that boat together. I like being in that boat. I like it enough that I'm driving an hour and a half to come tell you that I like being in that boat. You know, this is a miracle. And as my friend puts it, Ross, we are invited to participate in a miracle that started in 1935. You have been invited. You're in a chair. Why would you leave? Stay and be a part of this. because honestly, this is a miracle. Your best friends are in here, and you still have best friends that you haven't met. You know, I can tell you, it's a spiritual experience to be able to travel overseas and go to a meeting and find friends you never knew you had. But over a cup of coffee, it's as if you've met them. You've known them for 15 years. From that person that was sitting on a bar stool that couldn't relate to anybody around them. How does this miracle happen to us? It's an awesome, awesome thing. Don't miss it. I hope you too will be sticking around and celebrating 31 years. You know, because it really is worth it. So thanks for letting me share.